Welcome to my podcast series. I'm calling them samples, in keeping with the Lasting Supper food theme. I'm calling this one, Don't Let Anyone Dictate to You, inspired by Colossians chapter 2. Last week, I gave a podcast on my relationship to the Bible, in which I talked about the Bible as revolutionary reading. So what I want to do in this podcast and others to come is actually show you how that is true for me. I want to show you how my reading of the Bible actually formed revolutionary ideas in my mind and made me a kind of radical within the church and the ministry. I want to show you how the Bible forced me to ask tough questions and not settle for the status quo. I guess I want to show you how the Bible got me into a lot of trouble. Last week I told you about Bruce, the youth pastor who took me under his wing when I first became an intentional Christian when I was about 16 years old. I learned pretty quickly that he was in trouble with our church because he read the Bible in a revolutionary way. In fact, when he would take me to his house and we'd study the Bible together, it was almost like I was a part of an underground movement. It felt to me very subversive. I loved it. Maybe it was my way as the oldest of five kids, you know, the responsible and accountable one. Maybe it was my way of being rebellious. I was a closet revolutionary. The more I think about it, the more thankful I am that Bruce introduced me to the Bible in that way. I didn't have to unlearn a compliant reading of the Bible. My introduction to it was subversive. It was during these formative years in my young Christian life, I was hearing about Chinese Christians forced to meet in underground churches. I had Richard Wurmbrand's books, Tortured for Christ, and his Letters from Prison, and actually inspired my Prayers from the Cell series, Prayers from My Cell Phone. He was a Romanian pastor imprisoned and tortured for his thoughts and words. I was reading about Bonhoeffer, the German theologian, also imprisoned for his thoughts and words, and hung by the Nazis for his attempt to assassinate Hitler. I was then reading about the Christians in Central and South America being killed for their thoughts and words that challenged those in power. And I also remember reading a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, all of them Christians who died for their thoughts and words, and seeing pictures of the Christian catacombs where so many bones are collected and so on. And of course, these all pointed back to a rich tradition of revolution and subversion in the Bible itself. It reminded me of Moses and Isaiah, Jeremiah, Jesus, Paul, and John, all of them in prison, and most of them killed for their thoughts and words. It made me realize that the subversive reading of the Bible always has political ramifications. It has the power to challenge and change things. So I'm thankful that my introduction to the Bible was a revolutionary and subversive one. It's my default position when it comes to the Bible. That's why, from the very beginning, I was always suspicious when the Bible was being used to pacify, control, or manipulate me. I knew immediately if the Bible was being abused and used to meet the selfish agendas of those in power. I always know right away, like most of you, if not all of you, when the Bible is being read to rein me in and tie me down. I can tell right away. I can sniff it a mile off. And I think I have Bruce to thank for that. So I want to look at a passage today and talk about its subversive revolutionary message. It's one of my favorites. It's Colossians chapter 2. I agree with most biblical scholars that it wasn't written by Paul himself, but it is generally agreed that its substance is Paul. We know Paul was never in Colossae. He himself admits that in the beginning of chapter 2, but he was behind the church there because of Timothy and others. And the writer shows concern for the church because, like almost all of Paul's churches, if not all of Paul's churches, just after they were planted and started to grow, Paul would move on to the next one, and the Jewish Christian apostles would come in behind him and try to get the church to fall in line with the church headquarters policy in Jerusalem. And that always meant balancing Paul's radical message of grace with a little bit of law, which of course Paul was vehemently opposed to. So this is exactly what happened in Colossae, and the writer sends this letter to the churches there to encourage them not to mix this law with grace, that it's not necessary. So you see, Paul, or the writer, saw in what we may call the Christ was all that was needed. The writer says in 2 and 3 that You may have all the riches of assured understanding and have the knowledge of God's mystery, that is Christ himself, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So it's like Christ is the event, the manifestation of that which we call God, and all the mystery of that which we call God is revealed in this Christ event or story. The humility, the freedom, the love, the justice, the peace, the joy, the sacrifice, as well as the transformative power symbolized by the resurrection metaphor. So now the writer launches into five practical ways for these people to stand up for themselves and be spiritually independent and resist the poisonous and destructive teaching of these legalizers that came from Jerusalem. There are five practical ways we can stand up for ourselves and keep our own integrity and live a life of grace and love without fear. And they move in a kind of a progression that I hope to make clear to you as we move along. So here we go. The first one is in chapter 2, verse 4. It says, I am saying this so that no one may deceive you with plausible arguments. This is always the first step, plausible arguments. The teaching of legalism and the fear that comes with it appeals to the superstitious mind, the religious mind. I believe we are so desperate for meaning that we assign good things that happen as rewards from God and bad things that happen as punishment. Even though it might be terrible, at least there's meaning for us. It's not just some random happenstance terrible thing, but there's meaning. And this only perpetuates the idea that we need to behave or we're going to be disciplined or punished. So this idea is so rampant, not only in religion, but also in the world, that it actually sounds true. It sounds plausible, and it makes perfect sense because, of course, our perception of reality substantiates this. It is self-fulfilling. So when, you know, a hurricane happens and kills people in the United States, it's because there's gay people there. Well, you know, it's just self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? So that's the first step, plausible arguments that we need to be afraid. And therefore, we need rules to keep us on God's good side. So the writer is convinced that if we are rooted in this Christ truth and grace, then we will be fully established and will grow up well, and we don't need any additions that are based in guilt and fear that nevertheless sound feasible and plausible. So then the second one is in verse 8. It says, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the universe. So this is the plausible argument fleshed out and explained more. You see, once we agree with their plausible arguments, once we subscribe to their idea that have a long lineage of acceptance and agreement in the human race, once we say, well, that makes perfect sense, I agree with that, of course, to something that seems so fundamental, foundational, elemental, then we are captives. We're captives immediately. You know, the whole idea of fear and the use of legalism to abate it has a long and illustrious career. Thousands and thousands of years, people have believed this, and that we need to do something to avoid punishment, suffering, and death. But where has it gotten us? Nowhere except deeper into captivity. We've become slaves to the idea that we need to measure up to be rewarded, or we're going to be punished and die. We're captives because it is a captivating idea. Then, third, in verse 16, it says, therefore, do not let anyone condemn you in matters of food or drink or of observing festivals, new moons, or Sabbaths. You see, once we first agree with their plausible arguments, then we become captives. And now we are condemned because we simply can't measure up. There's so many possible rules to follow and break. Don't eat this. Don't drink that. Do this. Observe that. On and on and on. Ad infinitum it goes. Of course, because we simply can't possibly obey all the possible rules out there, we're going to feel condemned. We're always going to feel like we're not measuring up. We just can't seem to do it right because there's just so much that we could possibly do. We're going to feel like we've fallen short and failed, and we're bound to feel guilty. So then this takes us to the fourth step, and that's found in verse 18. Do not let anyone disqualify you, insisting on self-abasement and worship of angels, dwelling on visions puffed up with their fancy ideas, and so on. So first you agree. That's the first step. We need rules to be okay. And then once we agree to that, we must obey, then we're captives. But since we know we can't possibly obey all the time, then we're condemned immediately right off the bat. And if we admit that we can't obey all the time and we are condemned, then those in authority, those who oversee us, disqualify us because we've already disqualified ourselves. I mean, if I can't observe the zillion rules out there to avoid punishment and to be rewarded, then by my own admission, I am disqualified. Of course, you'll always find the few elite, and they're always quite vocal, who claim they're doing it right. And these are the ones who find themselves in spiritual authority. They're the religious leaders, and they come with advice. If you can't do it, then beat yourself up. Flagellate yourself, judge yourself, punish yourself. Worship anything that you can get your hands on. Superstitions increase exponentially, all in an attempt to overcome our guilt and fear. And we end up relying on the super spiritual who fast and pray all the time, who suffer for their faith, who have visions and hear from God and spirits and claim to have special revelations and knowledge and prophecies. Why? Because we're so afraid, and we need them to comfort us and assure us that if we just do the right thing, we'll be okay. So then, finally, this takes us to the last stage, the fifth one of spiritual captivity, and that's in verse 20. Why do you let yourselves be dictated to? Why do you live as though you still belong to the world? Why do you submit to regulations like do not handle, do not taste, do not touch? All these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They are simply human commands and teaching. Oh, they indeed have an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, and severe treatment of the body, but they're of no value. That's the end of that quote. This is the final and deepest captivity. We've become so desperate for the secret formula, so afraid, so guilt-ridden, so condemned, so disqualified, that now we will let people dictate to us how we are to live our lives, right down to the finest minute details. We're so desperate to avoid punishment, suffering, and death that we will let those in authority over us tell us what we can touch and can't touch, what we can eat and not eat, what we can drink and not drink, what we can handle and not handle, what we can read and not read, what we can watch and not watch, what we can say and not say, what we can think and not think, what we can feel and not feel. We'll even let them tell us how to orient ourselves sexually. We'll even let them tell us how to give them our money, how to vote, how to have sex. We've been reduced finally to exactly where they want us to be. They're pawns that they can move around the board game of life any way they want to. And we cooperate because we're afraid, and they know better. They know what's best for us. So these are the five steps to complete spiritual captivity. Every time the writer says, don't let anyone, he says that each and every time. Why do you let them? Don't let anyone. Right from the beginning, don't let anyone. You are your own boss. You have the right to think for yourself. You have the right and the privilege of being spiritually independent and not a slave of any other woman's or man's ideas, which is why I like the Lasting Supper's tagline, help yourself. Help yourself. Don't let anyone deceive you. Don't let anyone take you captive. Don't let anyone condemn you. Don't let anyone disqualify you. Don't you ever let anyone dictate to you. You and I both know that religion and the church is the prime place for this captivity to occur. It excels in it. I mean, it markets it. It promotes it. It thinks it's the right way. But it's also the way of the world, because so many institutions feed on our fears and our guilt, including governments, schools, universities, insurance companies, corporations, and on and on and on. But don't. I mean, resist. Subvert. Revolt. Think for yourself. Help yourself. You know, I wonder what the Colossians thought when they first heard this read. Eh? I wonder what the religious people thought when they heard it. I think they heard the words of a troublemaker, don't you? I think they heard subversion. I think they heard a revolution.